Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Patrick from the Poison Pen, and we're here today with another of our virtual events. And today we have Laura Jo Rowland, who's here to discuss her new book in the Victorian mystery series, A Portrait of Peril. And we were just going down memory lane about the early books, Shinju and Bundori. And I think Laura was here back in 1994. So it's been a few years. And then Karen Auden has stepped in to do the interviewing duties. And this is her latest book, A Trace of Deceit. And we have signed copies of both books in the store. And if you're watching on Facebook, I will be monitoring the comments and the Facebook feed. So if you have questions for Laura or Karen, just go ahead and send them in. And I'll pop up about halfway through and pitch them to the authors. And then meanwhile, Barbara Peters is at her home office there, and she's going to be taking over. So Barbara, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Thank you, Patrick. It is my home office. Actually, it's an old picture of my home library, but my home office being a wreck. But I like this picture, so I may stick with it for a while. Laura Jo, it's just wonderful to see you again. I can hardly believe it's really been 25 years. Good Lord.
Yeah, it really has been a long time, but I'm thrilled to be back in some way, shape, or form.
Well, we are too. And, you know, I absolutely loved your first series set in medieval Japan, well, Shogunate Japan. And if I remember right, because I'm still seeing the covers in my mind, they were published in the UK, weren't they, by Headline?
Yes, and in the UK and the United States, and I think it might have been 14 other countries. I don't remember exactly.
But they had, I have the English copies, because I collected them, so I was so taken with them. And I know how beautiful the covers were, which always leads me down, you know, the rabbit hole of why are British covers so different than American book covers.
Yeah, well, if you ever figure it out, let me know, because I don't know either.
No, but they were great. So how many books did you write in for those characters? It was a lot.
Yeah, it was 18, and it was, I guess, almost one a year for about 20 years.
Indeed it was. And you started out with your protagonist, whose name is, I'm blanking out, remind me?
Sano Ichiro.
Thank you, Sano Ichiro. And he was in a really perilous position because he had to walk a line in the complicated politics that were going on at the time. And then you brought him forward and you gave him a family, you gave him a wife, you gave him children. He had a constant enemy in the heir of the shogun. And that went back and forth for ages. And somehow Sano would always get just to the edge of disaster. And then somehow either events or people would save him. But he was a person of real integrity. So why did you decide to write that particular series? What in your life brought you to medieval Japan?
Well, I think the short answer is always, I watched too many samurai movies in college, and I really got taken with that culture and that world. And actually, there's very little that you can see in the movies because they take place during the Civil War period. So everybody's busy fighting and killing each other. So a lot of the elements of the culture don't really show up. But when I started digging, you know, it was a really fascinating world. And I thought, well, if there were ever a unique detective, this is the world that he would come out of.
I thought you did a wonderful job. For anybody who ever read Shogun, I recommend Laura Jo's books, which you may have to find in used copies at the moment. I'm not entirely sure. But we've been to Japan a couple of times and actually toured some of the castles and, you know, been to Shikoku where the male and female bridges were, where, you know, people being persecuted by the shoguns would leap up into the mountains and pull their bridges up behind them. And then you also wrote about Hokkaido and the Ainu people, the indigenous people of Japan, which was very informative and which I knew nothing about.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about them either, except I knew that Japan had a native people. And that's actually my post-Hurricane Katrina book. After Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, where I was living at the time, I evacuated up to Michigan, up north. And I thought, well, Sano was going to go up north too. So he ended up in Hokkaido, the Ainu territory, and he had a whole big adventure with supernatural elements all the way up in snow country with people that back then the reigning class of Japanese had very little contact with at the time.
It cracks me up to think about them today, you know, with their fabulous restaurants and the bullet train from Tokyo and world-class ski resorts. And I think they've also become an enormous garden center or purveyor of, flowers, sort of like the Dutch, only in Asia. So it's fun to read about them in your books and then think about them today. But I digress. We're here to really talk about Victorian mystery with Karen Auden, who's knows much more about Victorian mystery than I will ever know. So Laura, let's talk just a little bit about the books leading up to the current book, because is this book 6 in your Victorian series or 5?
It's 5, number 5.
Okay, so for those who haven't read the first 4 books, why don't you introduce your characters for a moment, and then Karen can take over the program and fill us in on the new book.
Okay, well, my series is set in late Victorian England, and my character is a photographer named Sarah Bain, who starts out as an independent photographer with a studio that she's running on a shoestring, always on the brink of bankruptcy. And her first episode is called The Ripper's Shadow. So if you want to start a series off with a bang, give your character a really difficult case to solve. So I gave Sarah Jack the Ripper. So along the way, she acquires some friends, just like Sano acquired a whole family and a bunch of sidekicks along the way. Sarah had to do it fast in the first novel. She acquires a gay nobleman and a 14-year-old street urchin, and together they track down Jack the Ripper in their first episode. So then after that, she becomes, by some strange quirks of fate, a newspaper crime scene photographer for a very rich man who is starting his newspaper empire. I guess you might call him a William Hearst wannabe, or a Rupert Murdoch wannabe, and he runs like the dirtiest kind of tabloid, sort of similar to what goes on in Britain today. So he hires Sarah and her friends to be crime scene photographers, and that's where they get most of their new cases and how they have most of their subsequent adventures.
Well, I like the fact that you've created a family, if an unconventional family, for her. And, you know, in a way, this has got some feminist, well, not in a way, it does have some feminist issues about a woman trying to make a living at a time when not too many women were able to. And, her standing up for, in a way, gay rights, even if it all had to be. People forget, you could be jailed or back. And Sharon K. Penman's time, I was thinking about her earlier today, you could actually die for being gay and being caught at it, so to speak. So I think you do some really fascinating issues, which Karen will be talking to you about. But I was thinking, when I was in England back in the 80s, I think it was, I hope I have this right, I went to Laycock Abbey, which is one of the very first places that photographs were taken. Do I have the right place? Karen, do you know?
I don't know.
I think it was an exposure in a window, like you know, when Henry VIII knocked out the monasteries or the clergy, a lot of English, either nobility or rising middle class or whatever it is, took over these buildings and created country homes out of them. And Laycock Abbey had a particularly, I hope it's Laycock, had a particularly good set of windows, and by accident somebody left something so that the light came through the window and exposed something. And, you know, it's one of those early photography stories. I should go away and check. I don't know why I brought it up when I really don't remember exactly what I'm talking about, but it made a real impression on me because, you know, we take photography and now with our phones and everything so much for granted. And it really wasn't that long ago that this happened. You know, the Victorians did a remarkable number of scientific and manufacturing, engineering, technological achievements that, you know, just kind of like all at once, from an agrarian economy to really the Industrial Revolution in this small country. And I think all the aspects of it are fascinating. So Karen, thank you for joining us today. I'm going to fade away here and let you and Laura have a great conversation. And I'm going to be listening. So thank you so
much. Thanks, Barbara.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara.
There we go. So I'm so glad to be able to talk to you. So my books are set in 1870s. So I'm just a tiny shade kind of before this book starting in 1890. I think my first question has to be, how did you make the leap from Japan to the Victorian era? Do you see any themes that are connecting your first series and your second series, or what inspired you to make the jump?
Yeah, well, I guess I went from too many samurai movies to too much masterpiece theater. So yeah, I've always been a historical mystery buff and always an English crime fiction buff. And so It seemed like in some ways the transition was natural. I guess I do have to keep certain things in mind, the cultural differences, like Barbara mentioned, that being gay was against the law in a lot of places. And I have to keep remembering that in Victorian England, it was, and in medieval Japan, it was not. You could go around and be as gay as you wanted in medieval Japan, and it was just not a problem. The shogun was purportedly gay. And if he could do it, well, okay, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I had no idea. I didn't know that. I remember the what was the play? Gross Indecency, which was the play about Oscar Wilde, who was accused of buggery and then thrown in jail. I saw it, I think maybe 25 years ago in New York. Liam Neeson played Oscar Wilde. It's a one-man show. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, we tend to think of these things as sort of historically evolving. And they aren't necessarily evolving in one direction. They may evolve in one direction in one way, and then they swing backwards and sort of a more of a pendulum swing. So you also jumped from a male protagonist to a female one. What kinds of changes did you have to make in that direction?
Well, I guess the reason I chose a male protagonist the first time around was because women's lives were so limited back in the 17th century. And you just couldn't have a woman going around doing all the things you need to do to solve a crime. Mm-hmm. So I have Sano getting married and having his wife solve cases, but you know, she solves one particular aspect of the crime and he does really most of the legwork because, you know, women's freedom was so circumscribed. So I really needed a male protagonist then. Otherwise, I would have ended up with a detective who couldn't go anywhere and talk to half the population.
Yep. Yeah.
So, you know, things opened up a lot more in the Victorian era. You know, women had a lot more freedom, even though we don't normally think of Victorian period as being a period of freedom for women. But, you know, compared to medieval Japan, it really was. So that was why the switcheroo there. And also I really wanted to write from a woman's point of view because I think it's fun.
Mm-hmm. It is. My three novels, they're interconnected. All of them take place in the 1870s, but each one has a different female protagonist. So sort of, you know, but the world is the same. And so the secondary characters move from book to book. It's only the protagonist that changes. And I too found that writing from I appreciate writing from a woman's perspective just because I just prefer it. But the 1870s and 80s and also the 90s, I think saw some drastic changes in law with respect to women. For example, in 1870, there was a Married Woman's Property Act that for the first time allowed women who worked to keep their wages. Because under coverture, they had to hand everything over to their husband. A married woman was not of femme soul. She had to, everything she owned belonged to him, including the children. And her wages, anything she earned, anything she brought to the marriage became his as soon as they were married. And all of a sudden now women could keep their wages. It was just a little crack in the iceberg. But I think that, you know, and there was obviously a lot of agitation for things like curtailing women's working hours. They had been sort of unlimited. And I think the act was in 1874 that said women can work no more than 56 hours per week in a factory. Now that sounds ridiculous, but they had been working more. So women were beginning to get a little bit of protection, a few rights. I mean, obviously it'd be another 50 years before they got the vote, but so they do have some wiggle room.
Yeah, and I think that was also a period of a big social reform in general. Mm-hmm. Like it's as if the authorities and the high society people suddenly opened their eyes and saw all the stuff that they didn't really think was right. I don't know if it was conscience or they just said, well, we don't want to see that nasty stuff. Get rid of it. Like, especially child labor. I mean, mm-hmm. talking about women working in the factories, there were children working in the factories along with them.
Exactly.
And children working down in the mines because they were small and they could crawl mm-hmm. inside the caves and things. Mm-hmm. So you really, really had some big, big changes there. Like, mm-hmm. it seems like this would have been obvious from our point of view that you really shouldn't have babies in the mines, but you know, back then had to wake up to that.
Well, and the children, the Education Act of 1870 or 1872 mandated that all children from age six till 12 had to be in school. And that was a huge one because of course that pulled the kids out of the mines and got them schooling. But we, you know, the fact that that was something that had to be legislated then was, you know, it's interesting. So, but you, I really appreciated that Sarah, you managed to find wiggle room for her without making her feel like a 21st century heroine, just kind of stuck in Victorian era. She felt Victorian, she had concerns that were Victorian, but you managed to find space for her to be a little bit unconventional. And one of the ways you do that is by putting her, you know, by having her be a photographer. So in a way, she's not in the action, but she's always photographing it and being aware of it and kind of coming to the action. You know, so I think it's kind of an interesting thing. So, and I was wondering if you could say a little bit about women and photographers, and was that kind of a common thing in Victorian England at this time?
No, it really wasn't. There were some photographers who were women, but I don't think they reached any great amount of renown during that period. It was later during the 20th century. But I always try to write about outliers in my work. Like I don't want to write about the typical person. Like Sano in my Japanese series is not a typical samurai. He's an outlier. He has a mind of his own. And he does things that conventional people don't do. And Sarah is really Sano in a corset and a bustle, if you want to put it that way. You know, she's got a lot of his characteristics, and I really think those are characteristics of the classic detective. You know, Sherlock Holmes, very unconventional. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a whole tradition of that. So I don't depart from that at all. It's just a matter of finding the oddities in the period I'm writing in and in my character that make it possible for them to do the things they want to do while still staying in character with their own period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So speaking of oddities, the dead man in Portrait of Peril is a death photographer. We don't have those now. And I was wondering, could you share, you know, for our listeners a little bit about what death photography is and what the ideas were behind it?
Well, in the Victorian period, some people believe that although ghosts are not visible to the human eye, the camera can capture their images on film or on glass plates as they were at the time. And so what you would do is you would set up a camera in a place that you thought was haunted, and you would take a bunch of pictures. Sometimes you would do long exposures because it was usually dark. Well, night in the graveyard, it's dark, and you know, there wasn't electric lighting back then, so you know, very dim. And then you would develop the plate and hope that a ghost showed up. Of course, there was a lot of fakery. They knew about double exposures, you know, printing multiple exposures even back then. You know, it's like as soon as one invention crops up, people think of a whole bunch of variations that, I mean, maybe pranks would be a way to call it. But some people took this very seriously. So the victim in Portrait of Peril is one of these ghost photographers, and he dies in a haunted church where, incidentally, Sarah happens to be getting married, and his body crops up during the ceremony. And on one of his cameras is an image that looks like him being assaulted by a ghost. So, oh no, he was murdered by a ghost. You know, there's ghosts on the rampage. And this was a very serious belief that I don't think has quite gone away, because there's this series of ghost stuff that my husband likes to watch on cable TV. And he just watches hours and hours of the stuff. And it's all about ghost hunters and paranormal. And some of these special effects don't look any more convincing than the ones in the Victorian ghost photos, but there's still a lot of interest in this. And if you look online, there's a lot of YouTube videos about how to take your own ghost photos and how to fake it if the spirits aren't showing up.
Well, yeah, and I think that sort of the same way we're fascinated by UFOs and by any of this sort of marginal, you know, uncanny, kind of 1 foot in the real world, 1 foot kind of maybe out of the real world sort of thing. And I think, if I remember correctly, mesmerism was still a thing sort of at mid-century, maybe not so much in the 1890s, but there were seances. And I know that, I think it was this, maybe it was Scotland Yard. I don't remember whether it was Scotland Yard or one of the other detectives, but there was a famous case about these two women who were duping all kinds of people. And they actually went from England. And when it started getting a little bit too hot for them in England, they popped over to New York and redid the whole entire thing over there under different names. So there, and it was one of those cases where American actually, and Europe and England had to actually cooperate and figure out who these women were. But I think they made off with, you know, hundreds of people's, you know, hundreds of pounds of people's money.
Was that the Fox sisters?
Yeah, there was Fox sisters. And then there was another pair too, but the Fox sisters, I think they were the famous ones. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually there's a whole town in New York that has a lot of mediums and people who run seances, Lilydale. I've been meaning to go up there and have a look at it. Yeah. But yeah, that's beliefs that never die. And I think the fascination is just going to persist, because, you know, we always know there's more to the universe than we can see. And well, maybe it does include murderous ghosts.
Yeah, well, it makes for good. It makes for something good to sort of, like, I don't know, poke at with fiction, at least. So I'm trying to think which one it was. I think it's season in, if, I don't know if you've seen, I think I asked you if you had seen the new masterpiece, Miss Scarlet and the Duke. It has 6 episodes so far. And the fourth one has something got like the death photographer in it. So, and that one's set in like 1880s, I think.
So I can't wait to see that one.
Yeah.
Actually, when I was doing research, Harry Houdini, of all people, was a big ghost debunker. So he had a photograph of himself taken with the ghost of Abraham Lincoln.
That's funny.
I think people, even though he tried to explain how it was done, some people probably did think that, oh, that's Abe and Harry. Well, yeah, I told you it was possible.
Well, for some people, I think it was probably reassuring, you know, the idea that, you know, they're, you know, somebody that they love who's dead is watching out for them, or at least still with them in some way. I can understand how that would mitigate grief.
Yeah, and there was so much grief during the Victorian period, because death was so ever present. You know, we forget in this day and age. I mean, we have a pandemic now, but they had all kinds of epidemics all the time. Like you know, my latest book is set in 1890, and they're getting into a flu epidemic, you know, right about then. Yeah. And actually, Queen Victoria's grandson, among other people, died during this epidemic. But, you know, it's just all kinds of cholera and typhoid and tuberculosis. Oh, my. Mm-hmm. Like, remember all the you know, most of the Bronte family died of tuberculosis. Yep. Mm-hmm. So death was just constantly dogging their heels. So I think it must have been comforting to think that those people were still with you. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we need a little of that comfort ourselves.
Yeah. They also had a practice of, and in fact, when I first read that this was about death photography, there was a practice of, for example, if your child died in childbirth, that you would dress it up and make it look alive and then take a photograph of it as if it were still alive in order to have a memory of that.
Yeah, no, what's really sad is photography was relatively expensive during the period, and for a lot of people that was the only photograph they had of their child. You know, they didn't manage to get the money when the child was healthy and alive, but they managed to scrape it up after the child was dead, maybe a family collection or something. And you know, so it is very sad. But not only children, but they would prop up adults, you know, anybody of any age that died and they wanted a picture.
I know, that's sort of painful thinking about
but
that.
I guess we still do that nowadays as people take photographs of their loved ones in the coffin. And you know, I think it is a measure of comfort.
So what do you think is, I guess one of the things I found very interesting about this book is the idea that there were, there could be, you know, a presence, ghosts from beyond death and, you know, maybe hauntings as it were. But the other thing that seemed to really come out in this book that seems somewhat related is how experiences from our past can haunt us. So not just people who have passed away, but experiences from our past can haunt us, and how parents can, you know, what parents owe their children and what children owe their parents as a result of some of these experiences. There seems to be a lot of kind of woven in, very, you know, feathered in very nicely, a theme about what family members owe each other, as far as loyalty and that kind of thing. Do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, that's interesting you bring that up, because loyalty was such a big part of the samurai code of honor. And I think that runs through cultural groups and family groups of all nations and in all times. You know, loyalty is very important, because if you can't count on your friends and family, you're just kind of lost out there by yourself. And so that, you know, that is a very important attribute of all cultures everywhere, I think. But as an ongoing plot line in my series, there's a mystery in Sarah's family past. Her father disappeared when she was 10, and she doesn't find out until the series begins 20 years later that he was a suspect in a murder. And he was he was on the run from the law all these years. Her mother told her that he was dead, and she believed that, well, not quite believing it or not quite wanting to believe it. And then there's a lot of question about, well, what do you owe to a father who's a murderer, if you believe he's a murderer? Are you still loyal to that person, even though he's supposedly done a terrible thing? And are you loyal to the mother who lied to you about all this stuff that happened in the past and just, you know, just swept everything under the rug, no explanation for anything? Of course, that makes for a very good mystery series where the character finds out, along with the reader, what's really going on and what happens as a result. But you know, I think people really are haunted by the past. I mean, doesn't everybody still think about things that happened in high school? Do we ever really leave high school behind? Do we ever really leave our childhood behind, especially if it's traumatic, or maybe if it's really happy, you don't want to leave entirely behind. You know, I think maybe that explains the craze for so many Twilight Zone marathons over the holidays, is you know, that really takes you back to those days when you really had nothing to do but worry about catching the next Twilight Zone episode because there were no VCRs.
It's true. And I know that when my daughter comes home from college, or when she's under any kind of stress and what I'm needing to sort of, you know, de-stress, she jumps back and reads things like the Narnia series or the Harry Potter series. And, you know, there's a certain comfort in that old familiar, you know, aspect. But on the other hand, I will freely admit that I do remember some things from my high school. I mean, I'm 55 now. So that's what, 30, that's 40 years ago. And I'm going to admit this for the first time. I've never told anybody this. I name some of my villains after people who were mean to me in high school.
Oh, that's a good one. That really works.
It does. It makes me feel good.
Oh, you know what else? What else is good is I belong to this Facebook group of alumni from my high school who have died. So I get to see everybody I outlived.
Yeah, there's a certain triumph in that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, well, okay. Well, they did better than I did back then, but I'm still here.
It's bad. I know. So my nephew for Christmas, I don't know if you can see this mug, but it says, "Please do not annoy the writer. She may put you in a book and kill her."
Oh, this
This is the mug that definitely. I keep. Yeah. So we're all, you know, we're all sort of working out through our demons. But, you know, and Sarah's got, she has not only the demons that, you know, her father, who presents a really troubling backstory, and also the mother, who is another troubling backstory. I mean, she's dead, but she still, you know, has, you know, is casting her shadow over Sarah. But Sarah has a half sister named Sally. And I thought it was interesting that you chose that name, because sometimes Sally can be a nickname for Sarah. And I was wondering if you could say, I'm always fascinated by doubles in books, you know, either doppelgangers or people who are kind of paired in a way. Do you anticipate, and in this book, the two sisters come together, and I wondered if you could say a little bit about their partnership.
Well, it's a very interesting relationship because neither of them knew that the other existed until they were already adults. Mm-hmm. Because Sally is the daughter that Sarah's father had after he disappeared on Sarah and her mother. Well, supposedly disappeared without a trace, but actually was running away from a murder charge. But he does the same thing to Sally and her mother. So they both have this disappeared father in their background. And that's kind of a bond between them. And also, Sarah is kind of a prickly person who was ready to just hate Sally because she's the daughter that took her place in her father's life. But Sally is a really nice, sweet person that's hard to resist. And I think they are two sides of a coin. Like, here's this this dark, prickly sister and the sweet, light, nice one that are grappling with the same issue of the disappeared parent from their childhood and what he's been up to that caused them to disappear, and having to face some nasty truths about their families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's, I found that a really compelling subplot, watching those two sort of work around each other and try and figure out, how do you feel about Dad? Well, how do you feel about our father? And you know, try to work together to both protect him, but at the same time start working to excavate the truth.
So yeah, and the big question, aside from whodunit and the major mystery that goes on in every novel, is Dad guilty or innocent? Did he or didn't he? So actually, I'm solving that mystery in the book that I'm writing now that will come out next year, if I finish writing it. So that part of it will be solved, because I thought that I really needed to wind that up. You can't carry that on for very many books, certainly not eight first series. So you know, I promise there is an end to that mystery in sight.
Yeah. Well, and you kind of hint at that, because that appears in the epilogue where Dad is is, you know, sort of brought.
Yeah, he's on the brink. He's gonna face his reckoning.
Yeah. So, can you tell us a little bit about what your next book is about in the series?
Well, the next book is, I have this fascination with carnivals and circuses. You know, I don't know if it had to do with my first trip to a freak show when I must have been about 10 years old, and we were at the state fair in Michigan, and, oh, there's the freak show, we have to go. And my parents are, oh, all right, you know, we don't know what's in there. So, you know, it was really fascinating. Nowadays, it would be just terribly offensive, and I don't even know if they do that anymore. You know, but back then, like in the 50s and 60s, yeah, mm-hmm. You know, they really, you know, they called it the freak show, and they had, I guess what they would call human oddities. And that, you know, that's definitely a long tradition, I guess, probably as far back as humanity. And then the Spanish court dwarves and, you know, the Victorian Museums of Curiosity. So this is the setting for my next book, is one of these places. It's kind of a combination carnival and museum of oddities, where there are some very strange people. Strange not in terms of physical aspects, but they have their own dark secrets, and the murder has its roots in their past.
Interesting. How do you do your research for your books? What is sort of your, when you come up with, I don't know whether this is how you work. I kind of usually, something peculiar happens and then something else peculiar happens. I put them together and then think, oh, okay, well, that's the beginning of something. And then I start researching. So how does your process work, and how do you do your research?
I tend to pick up on historical facts that intrigue me. Like for The Hangman's Secret, which is, I guess that's book number 3, I got very interested in England's history of capital punishment. They were still doing public executions till, I think it was maybe 1868, maybe you remember better than I do.
Yeah.
And they didn't stop doing hangings until 1968. So, you know, they have a long tradition. Hangmen are historical figures. And hanging is an actual art and science that you have to be able to do it right, or else it gets really messy. So, you know, the crime in that story is, you know, a very messy hanging that turns out to be a murder. So, yeah, there's always some aspect of history, like with the carnivals and the museums, mm-hmm. photography, definitely. And then Things kind of spiral out of control after that. But I find that as the series goes on, it also becomes more character driven, because you have these set of characters that you established, and then you have to come up with something that they could do that's in line with their skills and their personalities. Like I really can't see Sarah becoming like an international spy or something. You know, that's just within her purview or her friends. They're very much of their time and place and location. So it goes back and forth between characters and history. It's always that intertwining.
Mm-hmm. I tend to lean somewhat heavily on newspapers, and certainly like books. There's a wonderful book that I reread pretty much before every book that I start writing, The Ascent of the Detective. And it's covers the evolution of the detective from the Bow Street Runners in the early 1800s, all the way up through the development of, you know, the Scotland Yard and the CID, and then some of the, you know, some of the specialized branches and that kind of thing. Because I find those really useful. I also love to go back to things like Wilkie Collins and Anthony Trollope, and even some Dickens. Some of those sensation novelists like Mrs. Henry Wood, and reread some of their things, because there's so much just detail and sort of like the daily life and even the cadence of their speech. I find that really helpful to go back to. Do you have a favorite place you like to go, or?
Well, I like historic crimes. There's a good series on YouTube. It's called Lady Killers, and it's about female killers throughout England's history. And some of them are from the Victorian period. I think there's one about the baby butcher who features in my novel, The Hangman's Secret, who murdered something like 400 babies. They don't even know for sure. And I think England really has a lock on serial killers. You know, they do it like nobody else does. So historic crime is really fascinating, and you can get a lot of the legal details and the forensic details and things from just accounts of true crime. Mm-hmm.
I see Patrick's back with us.
Yeah, hi, Patrick.
Hey, how are you guys? I'm just have a couple of questions that have come through, but it strikes me that period that you're writing about is so fascinating in all these different levels. You know, you have these new strides in anatomy and body snatchers and all these different kind of trends going on at that time, and then a little bit later towards the turn of the century is that fascinating spiritualist kind of movement, in that whole period, just all kinds of different threads coming together. I have somebody named Mariah, I think, is asking a question for both of you, which is, are there decades in the 20th century that particularly intrigue you in the 20th century?
Well, I kind of like the 1950s, and this is partly because that's when I was born and I was too young to know what was going on, and now I'm finding out. And another reason is that I'm very interested in Sylvia Plath, the poet, who was a young woman during that era. And that led me to an interest in mental hospitals and the whole horrible story of psychiatric treatment in its infancy, which this is as gory as the Victorians, no doubt about it. Like the drive-by lobotomies and all that, that's really fascinating. So yeah, the 1950s were not as bland and placid as they seemed.
How about you, Karen?
I'm gonna be boring and say I'm not really interested in the 20th century. I lived through part of it. I think I am so firmly planted in the 1870s, and every single time I think, oh, maybe there's not really all that much more, I find some other weird, quirky fact that kind of just anchors me right there. So, I think, it's one of those things that the more research you do into something, the more fascinated you are by it. And Laura Jo's, I think that she's more comfortable jumping. I mean, she jumped from Japan all the way to Victorian England. So 1950s might not be much of a stretch, but I'm probably just kind of stuck in the 1870s myself.
This is more of a comment. There's a viewer that kind of circling back to the photography that you're talking about, the death photography, funeral photography. Someone named Brenda mentioned the fact that they have a staff photographer at the Mayo Clinic whose chief duty, I think, is, she says the Mayo Clinic has photographers on call that go in to take photos for newborns who have died. Did you all know that? I thought that was fascinating.
I didn't. Wow.
Very interesting.
Huh. Yeah.
Well, and also you were talking a little bit about death photography. And I was thinking about in the Old West, the frontier West, the gunfighters would routinely photograph, dead, villains or outlaws and prop them up in caskets and things like that.
Well, the samurai used to just take the victim's head and bring it to the boss. They didn't have cameras back then. If they had, it might have been a little different.
Well, then the cartels, of course, in recent years have, been very theatrical in what they're doing as well. It's pretty horrifying. Laura, have you touched, I don't think, upon your Charlotte Bronte books at all? And can you talk a little bit about what interested you about? I mean, the Brontes themselves are so interesting, the Branwell and everybody. Can you talk a little bit about what drew you to Charlotte?
Yeah, I have a, well, I guess it's sort of a series. It's two books about Charlotte Bronte as a suspense heroine. And of course, the fascination of the Brontes, those poor girls out on the moors, and just very, very sad, tragic life, dying one by one. But I wanted to give Charlotte the life that I thought that she would have wanted, at least in some form. She was a very adventurous person who I think was disappointed in her life in a lot of ways, because although she became a notorious best-selling author, you know, she had a history of unrequited love with men who probably didn't even know that she cared for them. And her family was dying, and she was a very shy, retiring person. And she lived a very circumscribed life, even for a Victorian writer. There were women writers of that era who lived much bigger, more public lives. And you know, she was just not up to that either physically or emotionally. So I wanted to give her an adventure. So I gave her two starring roles in international spy thrillers.
How cool is that?
Well, I don't know if she would thank me for it if she knew, but she did might be shocked at some of the things I made her do.
Were they published under their own names in their lifetime, or was it?
Oh yeah, they were. Yeah,
they were. Okay, so I think wasn't there Quentin and Acton Bell, and they had male pseudonym.
Well, not under their own names, but they were published in their own name. Well, in their own life, and then Charlotte was the one that came out. You know, because there was a lot of controversy about who is this writer, you know, this Currer Bell, and they were saying all kinds of things about her, and I guess blaming the books on the other Bells. So she finally came out. So people actually knew who she was before she died. Not so Emily and Anne. I think they managed to die before the the proverbial substance hit the fan.
Some of your interests in the macabre and the I find fascinating too. I have an interest in the carnivals, and is there anything else you can kind of give us a hint about your work in progress and about the carnival?
Well, it has a dwarf, a woman with a tail, and a tattooed man. And I have to confess, I thank Ray Bradbury for the illustrated man. Yeah. You know, these influences crop up all over the place.
There was a wonderful, you probably saw it, a B film noir called Nightmare Alley that was made out of a terrific, terrific novel called Nightmare Alley by William Lindsay Gresham. Are you familiar with that book?
I haven't heard of that one. I'm going to have to look it up. But have you seen the old, I think, German movie Freaks?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, that's an astounding movie.
We accept you. We accept you. One of us.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Well, now that we've carved you up into little pieces, yeah, you're one of us now.
Right. Right. Which for trivia buffs is where the Ramones got their little shtick, was from that movie, The Freaks. Although we digress, Karen, what can you tell us about what you have coming next? Can you tell us much?
Sure. Yeah, I can tell you, the book is written, and it's been, accepted for publication, although the contract is not in my hands yet. So I'm not saying anything more about it, but this is about, so I'm doing the exact opposite of what Lord Joe did. I am jumping to a male protagonist. This is a inspector at Scotland Yard in 1878. His name is Mickey Corvin, and he grew up a bare knuckles boxer in Whitechapel and a dock worker. And so when he is asked to throw a match, and he refuses, and as a result, the owner of the boxing establishment basically throws him out of Whitechapel and tells him not to come back. So he decides he's going to go off to Lambeth and be a policeman. So that's where he starts. And when we meet him some years later, he's about 30 years old, and he's at Scotland Yard. And he's haunted because his mother vanished when he was 11 and no one ever found out what happened to her. So missing persons cases claw at him worse than murders, because he can imagine the worst thing happening to them. So he has two cases going. One of them is a missing persons, and one of them, as of the first day of the book, is a young woman who's found dead in a boat floating down the Thames. And it turns out that she's the daughter of a very prominent, wealthy judge, and he is asked to solve that case. And part of the difficulty, and part of the, I guess, pleasure of writing this book, was when I found out what Lord Joe calls kind of like the funny historical fact that in 1877, Scotland Yard was nearly disbanded. Three of its senior inspectors were all found guilty of fraud and steering the police away from certain criminals and being paid to do so. There's something like £30,000 changed hands. I mean, it was a big deal. And these three people ended up going to jail, and they ended up, I think that combined, they were all senior inspectors, and I think combined they had something like 70 years worth of experience. So who knows what else they had been doing during their time at Scotland Yard, right? So there was a commission appointed by Parliament, house cleaned, people kicked out. They appointed a young man named Howard Vincent, who had actually previously been a newspaper reporter, to be the new director for the Scotland Yard. They reorganized it. And there was still a commission that wanted to take Scotland Yard out altogether. They just didn't feel that they could be trusted. Plain clothes meant you could get away with anything. So they did not want plain clothes men. So this is the context within which Corvin is now having to, because the trial was held at the Old Bailey, and there were mobs of people screaming things about how terrible the yard was and how they all deserved to be hanged and thrown in the Thames and all that kind of stuff. And this is the situation in which Corvin finds himself having to solve a murder case. So it's just a great time period. The 1870s is just a great time period for this kind of stuff. But that sounds like the
honorable man in a corrupt world. Yeah, that's yeah.
A little bit.
We don't change much, do we?
Yeah. No.
That sounds terrific, Karen.
So
now I'm assuming that's the first in a new series, I'm assuming.
It is. Yeah. So that one's written, and then the next one I think sort of my hook. I'm fascinated by the Thames, and I actually just got two really wonderful books. One's called Mudlark, about a woman who is still a mudlark. She still goes down to the Thames and hunts things, and she finds all kinds of really cool stuff. And the book was written, I think, maybe 10 years ago. And then the other one is called The Thames, and it's a big fat book all about the history of the Thames. But I'm fascinated by the river. It's kind of the aorta of the city, but it's also its cesspool. Everything ends up in there. And one of the things that happened in 1878 that was kind of interesting was the Princess Alice disaster. I don't know if you know anything about it, but it's not quite the Titanic, but it happened right there in the center of London, and 600 people went down with the ship. So, and the thing is, it was one of those fun ships where you could kind of hop on, ride for a while, get off, have dinner, hop back on. And so there was no manifest. Nobody knows who died. They know who survived it because, you know, they came out and they printed lists of survivors in the newspaper, but nobody knew who all died in that.
One of Jack the Ripper's victims would always go around claiming that her husband and child had died in that disaster, and nobody knew if it was true or not.
Right. Yep. They didn't know. So it's another one of those wonderful little moments. It's kind of like the Pantechnicon and the Trace of Deceit. It went up in flames, and nobody knows exactly what was in that enormous warehouse full of paintings and sculpture and jewelry and banknotes and all kinds of other things, because a lot of times people would, you know, for example, one of the famous things was they had a bed, a huge bed frame, and someone had carved a secret cabinet inside it, where they could store valuable things so that the stuff would be safe, but they wouldn't have to pay the insurance on it. So nobody really knew what was lost in the Pantechnicon fire and what wasn't. Same kind of mystery. I like that.
Wow, that's really cool. Now, do both of you, I'm sure you, before the pandemic, enjoy doing research trips to England? I mean, who wouldn't? And do you find inspiration in, you know, kind of walking the streets of London and you know, going on site, as it were?
I don't travel a whole lot. A lot of my research comes from, old books and old pictures. And a lot of online research. And one thing about the Victorian period as opposed to medieval Japan is there is a whole wealth of information available. You know, 17th century Japan was difficult, especially pre-internet, but this is almost too rich. I can get lost in research so easily, and I just have to tell myself, enough, quit.
Yeah, it can become a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I did take some trips to London when I was in graduate school. I spent about 6 weeks in London researching railway disasters, which was for my dissertation, but which eventually became the fodder for my first book, Lady in the Smoke, with a young woman who's in a railway crash in 1874 with her mother. And then later, as I was writing Dangerous Duet, which is set in a music hall, my husband had a business trip and I went with him, which is always a really nice way to travel. And I found the last Victorian music hall from the 1850s, Wilton's, which is in Grace's Lane, kind of near where the Ripper murders happened, in Whitechapel. And I walked in and it was sort of amazing. You walk in and there's the floors are sort of saggy and dark. And you can tell they've had a lot of beer spilled on them. And you can walk down the stairs into the basement. You can walk up and see the music hall itself, which is really beautiful and is still used. They still put shows on there. So to be able to be actually in the physical space, which I think is something you can do for Victorian London, or you can at least approximate it in a way you cannot do in 17th Japan. I mean, there's, even if you're to go to Japan, I'm not sure how much you could really kind of get yourself into the place that it was.
Yeah, that's kind of hard because, Japan is very modern and the places that are traditional are, I guess, kind of museum-like. You know, they don't have the, you'd call it the historic squalor or whatever. You know, yeah. It's not like that at all.
Yeah.
But when travel restrictions do loosen up, I want to go to England and see two particular things. One is the Wellcome Museum, which is a medical museum of oddities. And then another thing, this relates to what Karen was saying about the river. They have Thames at low tide tours where they put you in boots and give you a stick and you go poking around on the riverbed while they tell you the history and everybody's just covered in mud, but it looks like a lot of fun.
I'll go with you. Yeah.
Well, let's see if there are any more questions. I don't really see anything. A lot of people watching and just saying how much they enjoy your books. So I'd like to thank you both very much for spending this hour with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll see, I know we'll see Karen probably before we'll see you, Laura, but it would be great to see you back out here in the desert at some point.
Oh, I would love it.
Yeah. Well, thanks again. And you guys both have a wonderful evening and a great weekend.
Hey, Patrick, can I talk to you for 1 second after we get off?
Sure, absolutely.
After you close off? Okay, thanks. Thank you. Bye, Laura.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody, for watching.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.